Hello, everyone. Welcome to tonight's event. My name is Martin Grant. I'm the Dean of Science. I'd like to thank again our benefactor, Lauren Trache, for moderating last week's mini-science lecture. For the small number of people curious, yes, indeed, I was in the principal's office during last time. Last time we heard from Amir Raz about the science and fad of hypnosis, and there's all faculty science events have as part of their presentation a skill testing question. And so, for the crowd here, I have one skill testing question, and I have the answer, fortunately, because otherwise I'd have a problem. So I'd like to ask the audience, and it's a tricky question. I thought Dr. Raz actually kind of ducked a little bit. I showed up right at the end of the talk. So would mirror neurons be involved in hypnosis? Only animals. Yeah, this is sort of what he said. He emphasized that mirror neurons are only found in monkeys, and many of the findings from recent research has been blown out of proportion. But I wonder if he might have just been a little bit ducking the question a bit, because we're in many ways not too far from monkeys in our own way. At the end of the lecture tonight, I'd ask if you could write down questions. They'd be passed out. They'd be picked up by our skilled volunteers who will sort the questions before they get to me. And I remind you that good handwriting is a plus. And appreciated by the dean, who has trouble seeing them with his bifocals. Okay, so tonight's mini-science topic is vaccines, panaceas or poisons. The speaker is Dr. Brian Ward. Dr. Ward is chief of McGill's Division of Infectious Diseases, associate director of the Center for Tropical Diseases, and an investigator in the Center for the Study of Host Resistance. He's an expert on viruses and vaccines. He completed his medical training at McGill University in 1980. As a student at McGill, he received numerous scholarships and awards, including the prestigious Rhodes Scholarship. In the UK, he conducted graduate work at Oxford University and the University of London, and then was recruited back to McGill University in 1991. Tonight, we will learn that even though vaccines are among the crowning achievements of medical science, many people are convinced that vaccination can cause autism and autoimmune diseases, even death. The most virulent opponents to mass inoculation programs believe that vaccines are the sharp end of a global conspiracy. So that's not our point of view. Dr. Ward's presentation will summarize how we got into this polarized state and illuminate the science behind vaccines. Brian.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm impressed that you're all here. My son this morning patted me on the head and said, "It's okay, Dad. It won't be over by the time you get back." So we have a spy in the room who's going to raise a hand if the Canadians score. And there will be silence if anybody else scores. So we will try to keep all of ourselves abreast of what's going on. So thank you again for the introduction. Thank you very much for making this possible. I was very fortunate, actually, to have one of the best graduate students I've ever had work in my lab, who happens to be the Trache's daughter, Claire Trache. And so she completed her PhD just a short while ago. And McGill couldn't get rid of her, so we've recruited her into the MUHC, where she'll be running educational programs. So I'm here to talk about vaccines, myths, and realities. There'll be a little bit of mythology, math, marketing, psychology, and statistics. This is something that I've done with every medical and science class that I've taught vaccines to since I arrived here since 1990, and so I'll do it with you. What I'll ask you to do is to raise your hands. I'm going to go from 0 to 10, and if Vaccines are basically the best thing since sliced bread. Angel dust should be used in everybody all the time. That's a 10. If vaccines are essentially evil, tools of the devil, should never be used in anybody ever, that's a 0. I'm not going to give you much time, and I'm going to ask you to raise your hand when you reach the general impression of what vaccines are. All right? So 0. It always makes me feel good when nobody raises their hand at 0. All right, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. Okay. So here's what's happened at McGill over the last 20 years. The blue dots are the Faculty of Medicine, first year, and the yellow dots are the Faculty of Sciences in Physiology, Immunology, Microbiology, and Biochemistry. And in fact, 20 years ago, the students started right around 9, where you are now. But as you can see, over the last 20 years, there's been quite a massive slide in confidence in our young students at McGill in terms of their general impression of vaccines. I was very lucky to give a TED talk earlier, a TEDx talk at McGill for a more general audience, and I was stunned that about 25 to 30% of this now more general audience, not a science audience, but a general audience, actually raised their hands at 3 and 4. Okay? We are clearly losing this battle. And part of it is this. I mean, these are just drawn from the internet. Here are some of my favorites. This one is H1N1. This was just released during the H1N1 epidemic. And these are all our little kids with the needles raining down on them. The anti-vaccination movement is nothing new. The anti-vaccination movement started shortly after Jenner decided that using a vaccine grown on the sides, on the skin of calves, the smallpox vaccine, Vaccinia, was able to protect against smallpox. And many people believed, and you can see this diagram, this cartoon from the time, that in fact if you received this cow-based vaccine, you would start to take on bovine characteristics. And so there's nothing new in this. But we absolutely need to brace ourselves because there are many, many new vaccines that will enter the market over the next 5 to 10 years. Just in infectious diseases, the Public Health Agency of Canada assumes that we will have between 2 and 4 vaccines entering the Canadian market per year, okay, targeting virtually any infection because we have all kinds of new tools in immunology. There are also new uses for vaccines. We are developing, and in fact, in clinical trials now all over the world, we are vaccinating against cancers. We are vaccinating against autoimmune diseases and, in some cases, fertility. In many cases, these vaccines already work very well in animal models, and in some human cases, they actually work quite well already. There's also a government and philanthropic commitment to make this happen. And, of course, there's also profits, because suddenly vaccines are now worth a fortune. It's estimated by a number of the big investment firms, one of which was Lehman Brothers, which, as we know, didn't get everything right. But Lehman Brothers estimated, just before they disappeared, that the vaccine market over the next several years would increase at a rate of 17 to 18% for the next decade, while the pharmaceutical market would grow at about 3 to 4%. In fact, the current estimates now stand at about 24% per year for the vaccine market versus 1 to 2% for the pharmaceutical market. And you're probably aware that new vaccines like the expanded pneumococcal vaccine, the 13-valent and the 10-valent vaccines that have just been introduced into Canada, that was the first billion-dollar product. In fact, the annual revenues from those vaccines for the Wyeth Corporation are in the neighborhood of $4 to $5 billion, and the estimated total market is in the range of $13 to $15 billion, if in fact it's used globally. Human papillomavirus is the next blockbuster drug. Right? By the pharmaceutical standards, a blockbuster drug is a drug that earns the company $1 billion a year. And so these vaccines are suddenly out of the basement of $5 or 5-penny drugs or products, they're now blockbuster drugs. And so one of the reasons that Pfizer, this huge pharmaceutical company, bought Wyeth, another huge pharmaceutical company, just last year, was to get its hands on Wyeth's vaccines. This has never happened before. So clearly, we're moving into a new paradigm. And as many, many people, including myself, develop vaccines for everything, cold, urinary tract infections, this cancer, that cancer, all kinds of things, we're going to see newspaper articles like this. And the only thing that people will remember the following day is that. Right? Vaccine, sudden death. And all of a sudden, we've lost control of our word that has actually been a very precious word and a very valuable word for 50, 60 years. In fact, for much longer than that. Okay, so the whole of this talk is going to revolve around a series of myths. And these are statements that you've probably all heard. And so the first one we're going to talk about is that vaccines don't work and vaccines are not necessary. The vaccinated people still get sick, outbreaks occur, blah, blah, blah. Okay? Well, to some extent, this is the kind of data that people use to justify this sort of argument. So you can see here in the UK and in the United States, actually, the measles in England is the purple bar and blue is the United States data. You can see that the deaths per 100,000 were actually decreasing dramatically, but vaccines were introduced here. So that people who don't like vaccines point to this kind of data and say, see, it was going away before you introduced the vaccines. Well, that's a pretty good argument. On the other hand, here is data, this is now Canadian data, showing the maximum number of cases in the worst year in the 20th century. So these are the maximum number of cases for the, many of the vaccine-preventable diseases, and the percent change down to 1997. And you can see that we have, in Canada, we've virtually eliminated these diseases. If you go into the medical school now, or you go into any of our residency training programs, and you ask somebody, have you seen a case of measles? They only say yes if they've actually done work overseas, because they haven't seen them here. And while that first picture that I showed you still applies, in fact, many of the diseases were becoming less severe as our nutritional status and our living conditions came up, they clearly hadn't disappeared. And in fact, during my medical training at McGill, the conjugate Haemophilus influenza vaccine was brought in. Haemophilus influenza is a bacterium that causes a very severe and frequently fatal encephalitis. Well, when I was in medical school, Canada was not a third world country. And when I finished medical school, the vaccine had been introduced into universal use, and that disease disappeared. It went from killing children regularly to essentially being gone. So certainly there's a bit of truth to that tale that we don't need the vaccines because we're getting better anyways. Many factors contributed to our improved ability to survive these infections, but they certainly haven't gone away. Here's a particularly good example of that. The polio eradication program, actually in 1992, polio was eliminated from the Americas. We eliminated it from the Mediterranean and the Southern African region in 97 and 98. And then through the early 2000s, through massive programs. At one point, the Chinese, over a weekend, immunized about 85 million children. Okay, that's impressive both for the organization and the fact that they have basically almost as many babies as we have people. So in 2004, we were on track. We were clearly on track to eliminate polio from the world by 2010. In fact, there were only 7 countries left in the world where polio remained endemic, which means that there's circulation within the country at all times. And they were in South Asia and areas of Africa. Well, what happened? In 2004, in our very polarized society, the imams of northern Nigeria decided that, in fact, this was a plot to sterilize Muslim men. And so they advised the people not to vaccinate their children. Well, the fallout of this was predictable, sadly, that polio spread and has actually spread to about 17 other countries from 2004 to 2009 and so has returned to many countries in that Central African area. And in fact, those same things are being said now in Pakistan and Afghanistan in some regions because of the intense polarization of our society. So given a chance, these diseases will, in many cases, come back. Does anybody know how the imams of northern Nigeria were actually convinced to vaccinate their children? Well, in fact, somebody thought up the really clever idea of looking around the world for a manufacturer of polio vaccine in an Islamic country. And in fact, Indonesia has the capability to make polio vaccines. And so, in fact, the imams of northern Nigeria accepted a Muslim vaccine. I'm not sure that polio considers itself to be any particular religious denomination, but this is the degree to which this kind of miscommunication, and please, I need to make it very clear, I'm not slamming the imams of northern Nigeria or the Muslim faith in any way. Very similar miscommunications have occurred in Japan, and as you'll see, in southern England as well. Here are just two examples. In 1975, the Japanese decided that pertussis, whooping cough, caused too many problems. They didn't like the vaccine, and so they actually had some bad side effects. They had 400 cases and 10 deaths related to the vaccine. And so they stopped their immunization program in Japan. And in the subsequent years, the 3 years after they stopped it, they had 13,000 cases and 113 deaths. And they decided, okay, maybe we better use this vaccine. Even though we don't like it, let's work towards making a better vaccine. And of course, that was the correct strategy. In the United Kingdom, I'm sure you've heard this, Dr. Andrew Wakefield and some of his colleagues claimed that MMR was associated with measles. And they published a paper in 1998 making a link. Unfortunately, there was a fairly slow public health and scientific response, and there was a massive loss of confidence in the MMR vaccine in the United Kingdom. And to this date, some of the vaccination rates for MMR in the southern United Kingdom are in the 70% range. They're the lowest they've been in the last 30 years. And there are outbreaks of measles in the United Kingdom, and there are deaths which haven't occurred in the United Kingdom for a very long time. Okay, another point that's very important in any vaccination program to understand is that no vaccine is 100% effective. Some of them come awfully close, hepatitis A, B, the Haemophilus influenza rabies vaccine, if you get it in time. These are remarkably effective products. They approach 100% efficacy. Measles and mumps, however, are only 90-95% effective. What that means is that if everybody in this room is immunized, and let's assume there are 100 of us, that means that 5 of us, despite being vaccinated, will not be protected. Okay, that's fairly important. And some of our vaccines are even less good than that. Whooping cough, influenza, for example. So brace yourselves. There's going to be a little math now. There is no quiz, although I leave it to Dr. Grant to quiz you next week. Let's just say that we have 100 individuals and 98% of them are vaccinated. 2% are unvaccinated. So these two people are susceptible to measles. And since the seroconversion rate, or the efficacy rate for the vaccine is 95%, about 93 of the 98 will be protected, but 5 will not. So what happens when measles comes to town? Well, let's say 4 people in this group of 98 become infected, and these 2 become infected. So it picks off most of the susceptibles in the population. What do the anti-vaccine people say? Well, they say, look at this. We had an outbreak, even though most people were vaccinated, and there were twice as many cases in those who were vaccinated as opposed to those who were not. Right? You laugh, but it's not a joke. That's exactly what they say. While, in fact, the correct response is that the attack rate in the vaccinated population was 4%, versus 100%. These kinds of data are seen everywhere. Quite a famous anti-vaccination doctor 2 years ago, 2008, made the outrageous statement that there are only 2,000 cases of polio in the world, right? In 2008. And there are 6 to 7 billion people in the world. How can we possibly justify putting all those people at risk from the polio vaccine just to protect those 2,000 cases? Because that's an attack rate of roughly 1 per 3 million children. But that's not the statistic. Because if 95% or 90% of the world is vaccinated, it's not 2,000 cases in 6 billion, it's 2,000 cases in 600,000. And that's closer to 1 in 300,000. Okay? Which means 1 to 2 children paralyzed in Canada every year if we follow his advice to stop vaccinating. So this is not an old argument, this is a current argument, and it is a fallacious argument. Here's what he said. 2,000 cases of polio, and here's the math, okay, which I've just said. 1 to 2 children paralyzed in Canada a year. Dr. Jay Gordon, by the way, is the personal physician of Jenny McCarthy's autistic child. We'll get back to Jenny McCarthy. Okay, so the message is clearly here that childhood illnesses remain serious threats. No vaccine is 100% effective. Unvaccinated are much more likely to become infected. If you stop vaccinating, some of these diseases will come roaring back. And then in many ways, vaccines are victims of their own success, right? We live under an umbrella of vaccine-induced protection. There aren't very many people in Senegal or Bolivia claiming that vaccines hurt them. What they're saying is, we need the vaccines now. Okay, myth two, vaccines are not safe. They kill children, cause diseases they're meant to prevent, cause acute side effects, MS, autism, they contain mercury and other toxins. So at the risk of being accused of sounding a bit like Bill Clinton, what does safe actually mean? Okay, so I'm going to parse words a little bit here. Are vaccines completely safe? Well, if you define safe as harmless, then no vaccine, no medical product is safe. But if you define safe as prevention from some other danger, then vaccines are truly some of the safest medical interventions ever brought into practice. Okay, I have a fairly sophisticated 13-year-old son. He's seen this talk. And so he uses the 350 people who die annually from bathtub-related injuries to argue quite forcefully that, okay, he'll take the vaccine, but no baths. They're way, way too dangerous. I'm not going to do that. Okay? We don't have anywhere near 350 deaths, 100 deaths from vaccine-related things. So these risks need to be kept in perspective, and thousands die from car accidents every year. Okay? A much more complicated question, so are vaccines safe enough? Okay? So for example, for a number of vaccines, we've gone through several generations of vaccines. The first rabies vaccine discovered by Pasteur and Galtier and his colleagues in France was actually derived from the spinal cords of rabbits. Okay, so they infected rabbits, they pulled out the spinal cords, they let them dry, and then they found that by drying them, the virus became inactivated. And then they would give a series of 23 shots of progressively less dried spinal cord. Okay? Well, it turns out that the last 5 to 7 doses that they gave, depending upon the spinal cords, actually contained fully viable rabies. So that, in fact, the first few shots hadn't protected you, the last several shots would have killed you. And in addition, what they were doing was injecting, essentially, mammal brain tissue into a human being. And so many of these people, about 1 in 200, got a very aggressive demyelinating disease of the central nervous system called post-infectious encephalomyelitis, which had about a 50% permanent neurologic sequelae. So this was a really dangerous vaccine. But in context, if you've just been bitten by a rabid wolf, you have a 100% chance of dying. So 1 in 200 doesn't seem so bad. However, not good enough. And so we've actually gone through several generations of rabies vaccines to the modern one, which is now made in human diploid cells. And in fact, we've given millions and millions of doses of this vaccine completely safely. All of these vaccines are equally effective at preventing rabies. So here's a vaccine that's gone through multiple generations, not because it was not efficacious, but because it wasn't safe enough. Similarly with smallpox. Smallpox, when the disease was circulating, the vaccinia virus that we used routinely put hundreds of people into hospital and routinely killed dozens of people in Canada because it was a live virus and some people couldn't handle it because of their underlying conditions. So as soon as smallpox was gone, that vaccine was absolutely not safe enough to be used anymore. But if smallpox were to come back tomorrow, I'd be lining up to get my dose and to get my kids vaccinated because suddenly the risk-benefit ratio changes. Okay? Similarly with IPV and OPV, inactivated poliovirus and oral poliovirus. Oral poliovirus is a live attenuated vaccine, and every so often, about 1 in 2.3 million times doses, it paralyzes someone because the virus reverts back towards neurovirulence, the ability to enter the nervous system. So in Canada in the 1990s, we switched from OPV to inactivated poliovirus because the oral poliovirus was not safe enough. But for most of our vaccines, we don't have multiple choices. Okay, so there is certainly lots of work to be done to make some of our vaccines safer, but in the interim, as the Japanese discovered, you can't stop vaccinating because the diseases will come back. And what you need to do is not compare the risk of the vaccine to nothing. You have to compare the risk of the vaccine to the risk of the disease. And this is from the Canadian Immunization Guide, where you look at the effects of the disease versus the effects of the vaccine. And for example, diphtheria has a case fatality rate of 5 to 10%. So if all of you got diphtheria in this room, 10%, 5 to 10 per, of you would be dead. On the other hand, recipients of the diphtheria vaccine, there are really, at the current time, no deaths associated with this vaccine. So you have to compare apples and apples and insist that people who dislike vaccines do the same thing. So nothing is 100% safe. It is absolutely nonsensical, and it happens all the time, that I'm faced with a parent who gets in their car, drives from the West Island, comes to my vaccination clinic, and tells me that it's too dangerous to give their child a vaccine, and then drives home. Right? So there are serious problems with some vaccines historically. There have been contamination issues. There have been problems with viruses that shouldn't have been in some of these vaccines. And a small number of problems are still caused by some vaccines. These are tragic, but to some extent unavoidable costs of protection until we can improve all of the vaccines we use. And that's why we have to keep working to develop the safer vaccines. Okay, myth three. Infants are too young to be vaccinated. Children get too many shots. Vaccines weaken the immune system. Okay, you've heard this. It's in the news every couple of months. Well, in fact, if you look, so what you need to know about a vaccine is a vaccine is built to elicit an immune response, and the immune response is directed against certain little parts of the microbes, the viruses, the bacteria, or their parts that are included in the vaccine. And those are basically called antigens. They are the part of the microbe to which we want to elicit an immune response. Well, it turns out that in the 1970s, we were using a whole bacterium for our pertussis vaccine, which was one of the reasons why so many of those Japanese kids, and in fact Canadian kids, got sick with that vaccine. It was pretty dirty. It was a whole bacterium just ground up and put in the vaccine. Worked reasonably well, but it was dirty. So there were huge numbers of antigens in this vaccine. Smallpox has at least 200 antigens. Well, we've eliminated smallpox, so we don't have to give that vaccine anymore. And in the last decade, we've been using an acellular pertussis vaccine. We've pulled out 4-5 parts of this bacterium, and we've purified them, and we use those. So in fact, the total number of antigens that we deliver to our children today, even though we're giving more vaccines, is actually far lower than it was in the 1970s. So even though we're giving the kids more vaccines, they're actually seeing fewer antigens. And also, it just doesn't make any sense at all. Our vaccines contain tiny, tiny amounts of proteins or polysaccharides, right? In the microgram range. What kind of an exposure does a child get when a child skins his knee on the mud, right? That child is getting grams, at least milligrams, of junk, Okay? And heaven help you if you skin your knee on the AstroTurf in the Molson Stadium, because people have been sweating and spitting on that for several generations. So it doesn't make any sense that you cannot respond to antigens, because we're routinely exposed to huge numbers of antigens. So the message is really that the infant immune system is not weak. It's different. It's not weak. It responds to thousands of new antigens in the first weeks of life. It sorts out itself from its environment, right? It figures that out, the immune system. It deals with hundreds, if not thousands, of common organisms in the mouth, on the skin, in its gut. So the extra load provided by the vaccines that we deliver is totally trivial. It makes no sense. And even if you take the anti-vaccine people at their word, the dose of antigens is going down. So, myth number four, it's better to be naturally infected than immunized. Infections are natural, therefore good. Vaccines are unnatural, therefore bad. Natural immunity after infection is better, and a healthy body doesn't need a vaccine. I'm sure you have people in your family who believe this. Maybe some of you believe this. Okay, this is true in some respects. Immunity after measles, hepatitis, and some other viral diseases is, in fact, longer lived than after vaccine. But the cost is that you actually have to go through the crucible of the disease to get that higher quality immunity. And, in fact, you're either dead or chronically infected, or you have this lovely immunity. Congratulations. I personally think that this cost is too high for me and my family. There's also the theoretical risk when we vaccinate that we push the period of susceptibility until later in life. So if a little kid, for example, gets chickenpox, it's usually not a big deal. If I get chickenpox, I end up in the hospital. And so there is a risk when we vaccinate against some of these childhood infections and we don't give lifelong immunity, we do have to be alert to outbreaks of some of these diseases later in life. But we can handle this with boosters, okay? The people who say that, well, we're smart. We've got the new Glen Yards. We're going to have state-of-the-art care. We can take care of these things. We don't need the vaccines. Well, here are some of the vaccine-preventable diseases, and here are the current therapies available for them. And in most cases, they are either none, not really very effective, or the mortality, once you have the disease, is very high, even if you get state-of-the-art care. Okay? So it really isn't credible to say we've got all of these sophisticated new hospitals and new treatments and so on, and we're very smart, we can treat these things. So, vaccine-induced natural immunity may be very different, but different doesn't mean bad. Natural doesn't always mean good. Right? It's pretty natural to have a heart attack. Hands up, everybody who wants a nice natural heart attack. Right? And no hands. Very few therapeutic options. Healthy living is just not good enough. These diseases can maim and kill the healthiest among us. Okay? Myth five. Vaccine contains other infectious agents, can damage a child. Okay? Vaccine lots have killed large numbers of people. Vaccines made in bovine material can contain mad cow disease. Well, historically, this is actually true. Some of the early lots of smallpox, which was basically just slightly purified pus from a lesion on the skin of a calf, actually were contaminated with bacteria, and in some cases, hundreds of people died from bacterial sepsis. This was not very good for Jenner and some of his buddies who were promoting this vaccine. Every now and then, there is a mistake. So there is a famous mistake where a major hepatitis B vaccine was not sufficiently inactivated, and many military personnel were given hepatitis B by a vaccine that was insufficiently vaccinated. And the famous Qatar incident where the same thing happened with polio virus. In the developing world, this still occasionally occurs. So not all vaccine manufacturers are as rigorous. Occasionally, there are also surprises in some of our vaccines. For example, the early polio virus vaccines contained, and nobody knew it at the time, a very powerful oncogene virus called simian virus 40. And this was only discovered after about 70 million people had received doses of this vaccine. me included. I actually went back to find out. It turns out that simian virus 40, when you give it to rodents, is powerfully tumorigenic. It produces tumors in almost every rodent that it's put into. And so I wasn't there at the time. I was being vaccinated. But I have talked to some of the vaccinologists at the time, and they were petrified that they had done something horrific. As it turns out, we dodged a huge bullet with that vaccine, because if it is oncogenic in any way, it only induces tumors in a tiny, tiny, tiny percent of people, and maybe 30 or 40 or 50 years later. So this is not, however, an isolated event, and these mistakes will happen occasionally. You may or may not be aware that in the last 2 or 3 weeks, one of the rotavirus vaccines that we currently use in Canada was found to be contaminated with a porcine circovirus. Right? This was unanticipated. People looked for viruses before. The company that produces this vaccine brought a new technique to bear to demonstrate that their vaccine was even better, and to their horror, they discovered that there was this virus that they hadn't anticipated would be there. This virus doesn't do anything to humans that we know of, but at least 1 million people in North America have been exposed to this virus unintentionally. Obviously, this will be fixed. But in the meantime, of course, everybody's a little nervous right now. There's never been a case of mad cow disease transmitted by a vaccine, but it's all over the internet. So the messages. Pharma must supply vaccines that are as pure as possible. Accidents can occur, have occurred in the past. However, quality assurance in 2010 is a far sight better than it was back in the 18th century. The vaccine industry is really one of the most tightly regulated in the world, although GSK is the company that was implicated in this recent discovery of circovirus, and they should not be condemned, right? They took the most precaution they knew how to take, and then a better technique came along, they applied it to their vaccine, and they made a discovery that's very important. They shouldn't be punished for that. They're trying to make their vaccine better. No one knew that this was there. But it's breaking news right today. Okay, myth 6, vaccines cause autism. How many have heard of this theory? Right? Yeah, okay. How many know Andrew Wakefield? Okay, here is the fellow who's behind this. I'm not going to go through this whole list. But the bottom line is that starting in 1998, Andrew Wakefield published a paper in The Lancet based on 11 subjects purporting to show that measles vaccination was associated with and by implication caused autism. There was a long series of events resulting in The Lancet censuring Wakefield for an undisclosed conflict of interest. It turns out that Andrew Wakefield actually got at least 8 of those patients from the lawyers who were suing the United Kingdom government to support this, and actually was paid to be doing these studies by the lawyers. He was subjected to a disciplinary tribunal, and in 2010, actually, the General Medical Council of the United Kingdom said that he had been grossly dishonest, and The Lancet finally, after 12 years, eliminated the paper, even though 11 of the other authors back in 2007 said, this article is trash, and took their names off. Okay, it took The Lancet 12 years to do this. This hypothesis spawned a $15.4 billion class action lawsuit in the United States. And I've had the great, misfortune or fortune of being one of the legal advisors for the Department of Justice in the U.S. to defend against this case. Here's a little bit what we're up against. Okay? One of the major things, let's just go back for a second. Sorry, you always want to go forward. One of the things that was most important was O'Leary's work. John O'Leary is actually a very competent molecular virologist working in Dublin. And Wakefield found him and basically started a test. He made a new test using something called polymerase chain reaction, which is a very sensitive and can be very specific test for the virus. John O'Leary was completely competent to do this, but he depended upon Wakefield to give him his specimens. Okay, that was his big mistake. they started a company, O'Leary and Wakefield. And they charged the parents of autistic children 1,000 Irish pounds per test to do a test that costs about $25. So during the trial in 2007, the lawyers and the expert witnesses under oath testified that the PCR assay was perfect, there was no problem with it, that this test could tell who had measles in the brain, that it was vaccine strain, blah, blah, blah. And one of the most important references that they gave for all of this work was a very famous senior neurovirologist called Michael Oldstone, who works in Scripps, San Diego. And Michael Oldstone is, I actually have spent most of my life being very frightened of Michael Oldstone, because at one point, well, every meeting I went to, he was really mean to everyone I knew, because he would ask really tough questions, and he would nail you if you were not rigorous in your thinking. And so at one point, I actually left a meeting room in Philadelphia, and one of my friends had done a postdoctoral fellowship with him, and I came out, and I was very frustrated, and I said, "Is Dr. Oldstone always such a shit?" And it turned out he was actually standing right there behind the door. And so Alex Valsimakis said, "Well, why don't you ask him yourself?" So it was with a little bit of fear and trepidation that some 25 years later, I called Michael Oldstone and I said, "I'm working with the Department of Justice in the United States, and the people who are claiming MMR causes autisms are using your work. Your work is referenced extensively through all their expert reports, and I think you should know about it." And so he said, "Send me some of the documents." So I asked permission and sent him the documents. And this is the letter he sent back to me. And it turned out that when Andrew Wakefield in the early 2000s was going around the world talking to measles experts, including me, he came to my office and asked me to work with him and collaborate with him. He went to Michael Oldstone, and he said, "Will you work with us?" And Michael Oldstone said, "Well, I'll work with you on one condition. You give me the money for a postdoctoral fellow, I will make samples in my mouse models and my human subjects, and I will send them to your company in Dublin, and you will test them." And so they accepted that. O'Leary and Wakefield accepted that. And so they sent him about 120 samples, and they got 20% of them wrong, which shouldn't happen. And then he worked with them to make the assays better, and then he sent them back. But Michael Oldstone is a really good scientist. So about half of the samples he sent back were the same samples with different code numbers. Right? And so, in fact, on the retest in this company that was charging families 1,000 pounds per test, Michael Oldstone demonstrated that, in fact, they got 20% wrong again, even though they tried to improve the test. But really damningly, sometimes the test went from positive to negative and negative to positive. It was random. And so Michael Oldstone wrote the manuscript that proved, that stated that their assay didn't work. Remember that this assay is the basis of a $15.8 billion lawsuit. And in fact, the funding agency in California, which is organized by a congressional aide whose son has autism, went to him 2 years before his retirement and said, "If you publish this, we will sue you to the ends of the earth. We will make your life a living hell. You cannot sue this. Where in your contract does it say you have the right to publish this? We do not give you the right to publish it." Well, that was in the early 2000s, and I was talking to him in 2007 when he told me the story. And so, in fact, he had retired now. He didn't really care if they sued him. And so, in fact, under oath, they said this assay is reliable. But as early as 2002, they knew that this assay was completely fraudulently wrong. Okay? So the message, Wakefield and O'Leary published bad science. The PCR data came from one lab, a company. This lab was found to be incompetent. We, in our lab at McGill, have replicated this lab. Lovely work done by one of my graduate students, Yasmin D'Souza, and published in Pediatrics and Gut, that if we replicate their assays and we carry it all the way through to sequence information, they are amplifying garbage. And the Institute of Medicine and the National Vaccine Court have concluded that there is no association. This is the most damning statement written in the Vaccine Compensation Injury Court by Special Master Hastings in throwing out this theory, which was just published in 2002, to conclude that Colton's condition, Colton Snyder was one of the test cases for these 5,000 MMR autism cases, an objective observer would have to emulate Lewis Carroll's White Queen and be able to believe six impossible or at least improbable things before breakfast. Okay, which brings me to a falsely attributed quote. There are three kinds of lies, damned lies, and statistics. This was actually probably said by Charles Dyke in a slightly different way. And in the context of this talk, much more appropriate, there are three types of unreliable witnesses, a liar, a damned liar, and experts. Myth 7, thimerosal causes neurologic damage in vaccines. Mercury is a neurotoxin. Thimerosal is a form of mercury. Many pediatric vaccines in the U.S. at least contain mercury, and the mercury could theoretically cause autism. However, mercury has been taken out of all of the vaccines, and the level of autism has remained stable or gone up. And so, in fact, that theory is just impossible. Okay, we're almost done. So this begs the question, who are these people? Who are these people who are saying all of these things so aggressively on the internet? Well, there are some, and I need to make this point very clearly. There are clearly some people who are injured by vaccines, and those people need to be appropriately honored and compensated for the damage done to them. But then there's a whole other category, those who believe they were injured, the parents, and then the lawyers. My favorite Garrison Keillor joke is that lawyers are not all bad. It's just the 95% who make the rest look bad. I apologize for any lawyers in the audience. But there's a very small number of highly committed lawyers to actually pursuing these cases, independent of whether there's good science. And there's also a very small cadre of committed medical experts who do little but testify. And then, of course, there's the paranoid, including the anybody but government crowd. If the government says it's good, we say it's bad. And then, to some extent, there's the live naturally granola crowd that says that, you know, we can protect ourselves with canola oil and eating well. And you can. Remember that first slide. You can put yourself into a better position, but you could still be killed or maimed by one of these diseases. I put up this slide just to show how tangled a web this is. I don't know what was in the water in San Diego, but Hugh Fuddenberg is a master anti-vaccine person. He's lost his license. His license to practice medicine has been taken away, but it hasn't stopped him from spouting on all matters related to vaccine. In fact, two postdoctoral fellows working in his lab, Dr. Levin and Bayer, are married to each other and are two of the most common anti-vaccine experts in the U.S. Vaccine Compensation Program and also in the U.K. Martin Kinsberg, Schoenfeld in Israel, Mark Geyer, Jeff Bradspeet, and Krigsman are represented. In the case of Kinsberg, he's a very famous neurologist who's at the end of his career. He's testified in more than 200 legal decisions against vaccine. He's a professional witness. He earns, on average, it's actually not a bad living, he earns, on average, more than $1 million a year testifying, doing nothing but testifying against vaccines. Okay, but the plot thickens. Krigsman is Jenny McCarthy's gastroenterologist. Jay Gordon is Evan's doctor, anti-vaccination doctor, anti-vaccination doctor. Rick Rollins is the director of the Mind Institute, who got money with Wakefield and O'Leary to give to Old Stone and then subsequently threatened him with a lawsuit and therefore gagged him for a number of years. Wakefield and O'Leary started a company, Unigenetics, which I've shown you was it went bankrupt a number of years ago after these decisions of incompetence. But Wakefield and Krigsman were hired by what's interestingly called the Thoughtful House. By the way, if you're going to collect wackos who believe a certain thing, where do you think they will end up? Okay, California, I heard. Good. Where else? Come on, there are two other states. Florida, thank you. Or
Texas. Yeah. Okay, so Thoughtful House is in Texas. And they've both just been fired from Thoughtful House. But they left. They left. He's lost his license in at least one state. Fuddenberg is no longer allowed to practice. And Wakefield is going to lose his license based on the General Medical Council decision. But it's not just them. Here is an absolutely amazing article written in the, let's just say, fairly right-wing Huffington Post by Robert Kennedy Jr. And he writes incredibly about a woman who believes that her child has autism following a vaccine, that Katie Wright knows what sickened her child. Katie Wright is not a scientist, a doctor. She's a mother. And I don't have anything against mothers or fathers, in fact, thinking that they know what sickened their child, but not to the level of certainty. And, in fact, it's very interesting because he starts with this and then he finishes with this. Katie and her fellow mothers should be aggressively supported to fund studies that might verify or dispute them. But, in fact, the whole tenor of this argument, this article that he published, is that Katie is correct and that the doctors and scientists are wrong. Okay? Jenny McCarthy, for those of you who don't know, is actually married to Jim Carrey. And so we're just starting. We're just starting. We kept the gloves on for a long, long time. Okay? But this is actually one of my favorite blogs. It's JennyMcCarthyBodyCount.com. It's just been launched, and what it's doing is it's counting the number of vaccine-preventable diseases reported in the United States and deaths from the time that Jenny McCarthy started to spout off about MMR autism. Jim Carrey, who is a really spectacularly good actor, but actually doesn't know anything about virology or vaccines, has actually written long articles talking about the association between MMR and autism. Okay, so why is this happening? Well, we've always, as a society, been uncomfortable with acts of commission, right? If you leave your child without a vaccine and something bad happens, well, it wasn't really your fault. It was karma. It was Allah's will. It was bad luck. But if you're sitting there with your child and somebody's putting a needle into the child's arm, it's a little harder to deny responsibility for something bad that might happen associated with that vaccine. And this is actually, there are some fairly sophisticated philosophical arguments around this dichotomy of an act of commission versus an act of omission. The trolley argument or problem is actually a really good one. And it's basically, if you're the trolley driver and you are going down, you're hurtling out of control and you're coming up to an intersection and there's a child on this route and there are 28 people on that side and it is your choice to kill the child or the 28 people, choose. Right? Many people in the act of omission would say, I can't choose, I'm going to close my eyes and see what happens. Right? I'm not saying I would know what to do in that circumstance, but that's essentially the difference between an act of commission where you say, okay, killing a child is better than killing 28 people. But it's a very difficult thing for us to do. And as I think, I hope, I've convinced you, a safe vaccine may actually be an oxymoron, right? Because depending upon how you define it, then there may be no such thing as a safe vaccine. Okay, and I think this is very close to the end. What's happening? Why are these things happening? Well, just taking autism for an example, the average age of a diagnosis of autism is around 30, 31 months of age. Okay, well, when do we give measles vaccine? Okay, depending upon the province you live in Canada, we give our first dose and second dose clustered around here, or we give our first and second dose there. And so, in fact, it makes absolute sense. If autism is diagnosed routinely right around this time of year, of life, then many, many children, just by chance, are going to have a vaccination in close temporal association with their vaccine and have nothing to do with causality. Okay, so let's just make the point that's fairly topical. Two unlikely events occurring in close temporal relationship in many of our minds must be related. right? So in fact, the fact that the Canadians overcame a 3-1 deficit and are playing at this very moment, do we have any fingers? 0-0, okay? Does not necessarily mean that we can blame them for the April snowstorm we just had, right? They're two incredibly unlikely events, and in most people's minds, if two incredibly unlikely events happen in close temporal association, then they must be related. And that is the essential fallacy of most of the anti-vaccination movement. Okay, myth 9, okay, and this is the last one. We simply can't afford all vaccines, to offer all vaccines to all of the children of the world. This is the global burden of disease, and I'm not going to show this. Well, no, I'm not going to show it. It basically shows that there are many, many infectious diseases that remain in the developing world, and that these are the ones for which we have vaccines, but these are the ones for which we need vaccines. And the vast majority of this burden falls in the developing world, and so we need to take our responsibility and make vaccines for them as well. This is my favorite slide of all. It was put together by Danielle Cole, who actually works in the Rixensart office in GSK, and it's $1,995. But in $1,995, it was estimated that you could provide all of the needs for every child in the world for $13 billion a year. Okay? The current estimate is about $30 billion a year. Okay? So these are $1,995. But look at what the world is estimated to spend on golf. Okay? Now, my wife drinks wine and I drink beer. So, beer, you can't touch. But surely, we could offer vaccines to all of the children in the world if my wife would just not drink quite so much wine. This was before Afghanistan and Iraq, so this number has been dwarfed. And I've specifically left one thing off of her chart. How much does the world spend on pet care? Come on. I would say 50% of you in the audience are guilty just by your reaction. Come on. What's the number? So, is it 40 billion? Is it 100 billion? $350 billion. Okay? So anybody at any point who says we cannot afford to provide vaccines for the children of the world needs to see this slide. Okay? So I hope, since most people only retain three things from any lecture or any talk, here are the three things. I hope I've convinced you that we're losing ground, that these vaccination programs are at risk, that the challenge has to be met with both science and passion, probably in equal proportions, that vaccines aren't perfect, but they're pretty close, and like clean food, like clean water, food, and shelter, I think vaccines should be basic human rights. And these are my three kids and my dog, all of whom are fully vaccinated, and I give them a 9.98. Thanks for your attention.
Okay, thanks very much, Brian. And I shouldn't read, but I have here. I have a wonderful parting gift.
But I can't leave yet, right? Thank you very much.
And I'd ask if people could write very legibly questions which our skilled volunteers will pick up and sort and hand to me, and then I'll ask the questions. Let's see, what time are we at? Yep. And we'll have a good period of time for asking questions. Well, I'd like to recognize Cappy Flanders, who's here tonight. Cappy is the auteur of all the mini-series and started them at McGill, starting with Mini-Med and then Mini-Law, Mini-Music, and Mini-Science a few years ago. Okay, we're ready. We're ready for the question period. And on the handwriting scale, I would give this a 7. You know who you are when I read your question. With all the new vaccines coming on the market, how do we know that the new ones have, one, no mistakes, and two, quality assurance is there?
So both good questions.
Yeah.
You can never prove a negative. You can't be 100% certain of anything. Where humans are involved, where machinery is involved, there's always a chance that something bad will happen. But because we give vaccines to healthy individuals, the quality control is tighter for vaccine manufacturer than for virtually any other product. And so while you can never be 100% certain, whoever thought that anybody would put melamine into baby food, right? So, you know, you're feeding your child baby food, baby formula, and obviously, you know, that wasn't a mistake. If something happens like this circovirus in the GSK rotavirus vaccine happens, it certainly was. There wasn't any negligence. They just didn't have the test that would allow them to say that it was there at the time that they were making the vaccine. And I think that to some extent, we need to congratulate the companies that actually continuously monitor to try to make their products better rather than crucifying them, because it's entirely possible that the other rotavirus vaccine has something else in it, but the other company just hasn't looked. So, I think we have to, at some level, trust that these big pharmaceutical companies are doing everything they can, which is a lot, to make these vaccines as safe as possible.
Here's an interesting question. Can vaccine combinations have a potential effect on their effectiveness? And if you split measles vaccine into three separate vaccines, would that be more effective with less total side effects?
So theoretically, yes. Yeah. It's possible that if you were to separate out measles, mumps, rubella, and now varicella into four different shots, that you might, at the very least, be able to tell which one caused a problem. Certainly one of the concerns when we started to combine the vaccine antigens was that if something bad happened, we wouldn't know what component of the vaccine had caused the problem. When the original testing was done, in fact, people did give measles alone, measles plus rubella plus mumps. And more recently, they've done similar studies looking at MMR alone versus MMR plus varicella. And those studies are not done with millions and millions of people, but certainly with the thousands of children and people who were exposed to those vaccines, there were no major differences. However, a very rare adverse event you can't predict. So we are actually thinking about going back to test that hypothesis. Oh, before I say this, the pressure to put those together did not come from the pharmaceutical industry. It came from parents who said, I don't want my child to have four doses. One would be much better, please. And so, in fact, parents are phenomenally happy with, by and large, are phenomenally happy with the ability to deliver six, seven vaccines in a single dose and protect their child with one shot. We're now at McGill. We're thinking about going back. Cheryl Picciarillo and I are thinking of working with some people at the University of British Columbia to ask that question about whether measles alone versus mumps alone might have some subtle effects on the immune system that we didn't anticipate and we couldn't measure even 5 years ago. But we now have some very sophisticated tools, and we're going to be looking at the effects on long-term memory to see if combining them has an effect on the durability of the memory. But that's brand new. We haven't got money to do it yet. Vote to your members of parliament. Tell them to give us money.
And here we've got an audience member has as deigned to correct a factual error
Uh-oh.
In your talk.
Uh-oh.
That apparently Jenny McCarthy was never married to Jim Carrey.
Oh, and she is his partner.
And they and
not anymore. And the, I am just behind on my People magazine.
Oh, that's
when
cruel.
Did this happen?
Last one.
Last week? Last week?
Last one.
Oh, okay. Thank you for the update.
And this one had me. I was thinking of asking this one at the end myself, but someone here has it as well. It was because when they started talking about anthrax several years ago, they talked about stockpiles of diseases that some countries are keeping, and it kind of creeped me out, to be honest. What are the conditions under which smallpox might return?
Well, natural.
Yeah.
Smallpox is a DNA virus. It can live for very long periods of time frozen. And so it is at least theoretically possible that smallpox could emerge from permafrost, a corpse in the permafrost. I think it's far more likely that it would emerge from some nasty person's lab. So those are the two possibilities. This is actually far scarier than you know.
Oh, no.
So
I have no idea what
this is a true story. It happened just a couple of years ago. One of my colleagues, Marcel Baer, who's a clinician scientist at the Montreal General, was reviewing the medical student bursary, the grants, summer grants. The McGill and the faculty are very generous in promoting research within the Faculty of Medicine. And one of the things he was reading was this very enthusiastic student talking about what he was going to do with all of these bacteria. I'm not sure if it was a him or a her. But the student was going to do a test on this whole range of bacteria. And so there was E. coli and staphylococci. And as Marcel was reading through this list, he came across Yersinia pestis, which is the agent of plague, and Francisella tularensis, which is the agent of tularemia, and Bacillus anthracis, which is the agent of anthrax, and Brucella, which is the most commonly transmitted very severe disease in a lab. And so he thought, oh, well, this is really funny. Of course he hasn't done this. And no one in their right mind would let him do this. But Marcel is a very compulsive individual. So he called up the student, and he said, how's your project going? And the student actually said, well, I've got all the bacterial strains, but I haven't got them all growing yet. Somebody at Lyman Duff, who will remain nameless, had just given him a list of the bacteria that were in one of our freezers and said, go to it, take what you want. And this complete innocent had gone in and had pulled out several Class A bioterrorism organisms from one of our freezers. No, because he hadn't tried to grow them yet. He had them in the little frozen vials. So Marcel did a very good thing.
Okay, another question in this Faculty of Science event.
It never happened in the Faculty of Science. But
the things that happen, man. Okay, this is kind of another question I was thinking of asking. What's the timeline or the hopes for vaccines against a disease like hepatitis C or even cancer?
In fact, they're great. They've never been better. Robert Bourassa was a recipient of one of the first cellular vaccines, and it extended his life. He had a malignant melanoma that was going to kill him in a couple of months, and he had a significant extension to his life because he had an experimental T-cell, so a living cellular vaccine. They took out his own cells, they stimulated them in a test tube, and then they gave him back his cells, and they were able to fight off the cancer for many more months. Many, many cancer vaccines are approaching the market. We will, I think, in 2010, have our first cancer vaccines. In fact, hepatitis B is a cancer vaccine. It prevents hepatocellular carcinoma. And human papillomavirus vaccine is, of course, a cancer vaccine because it prevents cervical cancer.
Right, right.
But we also have all kinds of new tools. We have new ways of revving up the immune system to get the T-cell immunity that you need to attack cancer, tuberculosis, malaria, and probably hepatitis C and HIV. These vaccines, when we get them, when we test them, are not all going to be benign, because we are going to be revving up and then putting into the body things called natural killer cells, cytotoxic T lymphocytes, right? These are not quite as benign as a little antibody that floats around, right? We're going to hurt people in some cases when we give them these vaccines. On the other hand, we're going to save some people. Just to give you a really good example of this, melanoma is a malignant tumor of the pigment-producing cells of the body. So a mole, a dark mole, is a potential melanoma, right? If it goes, if it becomes a cancer, those melanin-producing cells can spread all over the body, and it's a very dangerous tumor. We now have many candidate vaccines that can be given to people who have melanoma, and in lots of cases, you can actually get their melanoma to go away. Does anybody want to guess what a really good sign that the vaccine is working might be? Yes. If the vaccine stimulates an immune response that starts picking off some of the normal melanin-producing cells, it's called vitiligo, right? Those patches of white that you see. That is an incredibly good sign that the cancer is being killed and there's a little bit of collateral damage. So would you rather be dead with your melanoma or live for many years potentially with a few white spots? But that's the kind of trade-off I think we're going to be seeing with some of these cancer vaccines and the vaccines for chronic viral diseases.
Here's a question that several people had, and I was curious about myself. What's the status of the shingles vaccine, if you know?
It's licensed. It works about 60% of the time, which is a little bit problematic if you have to pay for it. Actually, if you're in a position of recommending it to people. So it appears to work. It appears to work by boosting the cellular immune response to the vaccine. That was published about 2 weeks ago. It prevents about 60% of the cases. The cases that do occur are about 60% less severe. And post-herpetic neuralgia, which is that chronic pain syndrome, is reduced by about 60% as well. So it's the 60% vaccine. Now, the trouble is, if you recommend it to your mom or your dad or a relative, and then it doesn't work, if they fall into the 40% where it doesn't work, it doesn't help very much to explain to them, well, it could have been worse, because they've put out the $200 or $300, whatever it is, for the vaccine, and they've got the problem. So I have actually given some advice that hasn't been taken to the company that makes it. I suggested to them that this should be their first money-back guarantee vaccine, that they should bring the vaccine in and give it to people, and if the people still got an episode of shingles, they'd refund their money. I think they should have listened to me, because I think the vaccine uptake would have been a lot better. Right now, it's an expensive vaccine, and you have considerable benefit, but it's not one of the 100% vaccines.
Okay. And someone has asked, this seemed improbable to me, but someone must have heard this from somewhere, is it true that there's a vaccine that blocks receptors of cocaine, therefore blocking them and not making people addicted?
Yes, and nicotine. There are candidate vaccines. This is one of the hottest areas of addiction treatment, in that you can generate a vaccine that will prevent, that will either recognize the active drug, which is a little bit tricky because there are some really good pothead chemists out there who can just change the drug a little bit and give you the high anyways. But if you block the receptor to which all of these drugs bind, without activating the receptor, because then that vaccine could become a pretty good drug of abuse itself, those vaccines work. And they work. They already work in animals. You can take a rat that's completely addicted, for example, to nicotine, and you can take away the high. And a rat that was sitting there, you know, doing this, saying, "Give me a smoke," jittering, you can actually take it away, or prevent it from happening in the first place. So yes, there are going to be, I think, preventative and in some cases therapeutic vaccines for substance abuse.
What do you think of the H1N1?
Oh, hang on. Oh. 1-0? Montreal? Yes! Okay, this is a great talk.
Hey, this is... We're taped.
Thank you.
What do you think of the H1N1 vaccine? Did you yourself get vaccinated? And did they have enough time to test the long-term effects of the vaccine?
Well, so the answer to the second part of the question is clearly no. How can you test the long-term effects of a vaccine when you're racing to get it into as many arms as possible? So absolutely not. We knew unbelievably little. I sat on the pandemic vaccine task group, the academic public health group that gave advice to the Public Health Agency of Canada for the use of the vaccine. And I can tell you I spent... I don't even know how many hours, but in some cases whole weekends, talking and teleconferences about what to do with young kids, pregnant women, who should get the vaccine first. Actually, one of the really interesting things was that one of the petitions we got to put very high up on the priority list for who should get the vaccine first, anybody want to guess? It came from the BC government to the Prime Minister's office to us. Yeah, the Olympic Committee. Yeah, they wanted the vaccine first. They didn't get it first, just by the way. I probably shouldn't have told you that, actually.
No.
So I actually got the disease. I was in June of 2009, I got the disease. As soon as the vaccine was available, I vaccinated my family. I actually was doing a study on one of the lots of the vaccine, and I had some left over. And so I actually brought it home, and I vaccinated my kids and my wife, which means that I got the blame for their really, really sore arms for the next couple of days. No, it was a new vaccine. And so I think what we all have to do is we have to take a deep breath. And as we were moving forward with this vaccination program, we didn't know what was going to happen. Remember Mexico? There were villages where there were, 10, 15 deaths. There were a lot of people who got really sick in Mexico. We had no idea what was going to happen. And so we were committed to a course. And as a public health doctor, fortunately, I was not the one who had to finally make the decision to go with this or go with that. But I felt very sorry for a lot of my public health colleagues because, in fact, they were damned if they did and damned if they didn't. Because if the disease had come roaring out of Mexico and they had decided to go slow and 0.5% of the Canadian population was dying, they would have been crucified. On the other hand, they decided that this was a pandemic. This looked like it was going to be bad. Full speed ahead, let's get everybody vaccinated. And as soon as, it looked like it wasn't so bad, then everybody started, rear view advising, saying, "God, you guys are idiots." Okay, so let's just, there are two things that very few people know, but I think it's very illustrative of this point. The week that H1N1 came out of Mexico, okay, when we first realized that this was probably a pandemic virus coming out of Mexico, the federal government had just committed to purchase millions of doses of the H5N1 vaccine, right? The one that we had been worried about for the decade before, right? They just quietly paid the money because it still is a good idea. That virus has an 80% crude mortality, and it's currently hypermutating in the birds all over the world. Okay? That is still a horrifically dangerous virus, and courtesy of your federal government, we have several million doses stockpiled, but they haven't announced it because if they had, Can you imagine what the press would have said? You know, you guys are idiots. You know, why are we buying H5N1 virus when with H1 is an obvious problem? Similarly, in the month before the H1N1 came out, you probably read some newspaper articles about our antiviral stockpile, which we bought about 4 years ago and was expiring. It was going to expire in September 2009, right? And there were people writing in our Gazette and in other papers saying, God, you guys wasted a lot of money. How could you be so stupid? You know, we didn't hear any of those reporters saying, I was really dumb writing that article. You know, because in fact, you guys turned out to be pretty smart because we had one of the largest stockpiles of antivirals when this completely unanticipated virus came out of the woodwork. So these public health decisions have to be looked at in terms of insurance. Okay? How many of you have paid insurance in your lives? Right? Hands up, everybody. How many of you have actually claimed any significant amount of that insurance back? Right? No hands. Well, some of you. Okay? That's exactly what these public health pandemic programs are all about. We hope, in fact, that we are wasting this money.
There's only time now for one last question, which is mine.
Oh.
A few people are still laughing at that joke. I apologize. This bothered me when you're speaking, not about your talk, but what you're talking about people. You mentioned these doctors who were essentially preying on sick people and their families and trying to get, you know, huge amounts of money into their pockets for it. But I don't know quite how to put this, but I've usually found that most people are misguided or they have their own belief system, but I haven't found too many people who are really, that to me would be truly evil. And just to put it in a very bald way, how do those collection of doctors actually, it doesn't matter how much money you have if you're you know, an evil person who preys on children, how do they live with themselves actually?
I don't think any of these physicians or scientists go into this saying, you know, I'm an evil person, this is how I can make my living. I don't think that's true. I think that what happens is that they become involved through caring for patients or dealing with individuals, and they become convinced that there's some truth to the arguments or the claims being made. We can never forget, for example, the mothers of Lyme, Connecticut, right? The mothers of Lyme, Connecticut said something's going on in our community. Our kids are sick. Our kids have these swollen knees. Our kids have these headaches. And in fact, it was the mothers that alerted the CDC to send Alan Steele, who made his career out of Lyme disease. Right? So in fact, many of the signals that are brought to medicine or brought to science are generated by concerned parents or concerned physicians. And most of these vaccine adverse events are actually plausible. They're biologically plausible at the outset. What happens, unfortunately, is that any hypothesis, right, a testable hypothesis, one hypothesis is that God exists, right? That's an untestable hypothesis, and so that will always remain a hypothesis, right? I hope so, until the end of time, perhaps. But MMR causes autism is a testable hypothesis. It was quite plausible when it was initially put forward. But then any hypothesis that is testable needs to be tested, and it lives or dies on the science. And what happens is that some of these individuals become so invested in what they believe to be the truth, in some cases, I think, in completely good faith, that they lose their scientific objectivity, and then they become a part of what is a paranoid reaction to what they believe to be an attack upon them, upon their credibility, upon these poor people who, I mean, let's face it, the each one of these events starts with a damaged person, in most cases a damaged child. And sometimes I feel horrible standing up in a court, for example, in the United States, showing how bad the science is, because I know that by doing this in the American system, that child and that family will not get $1.5 million in compensation, which they need to support the child. I don't know how to balance that, because I actually do. I've made a point in every one of the cases to try to meet the parents of the child and the child and talk to them as a human being, and not be this distant expert who's basically saying what you believe is wrong. Because, in fact, there is a damaged child there. In our system, in Quebec, that tends not to happen, because those parents and those children get, I think, by and large, the support they need, whether they win compensation or not. Not perfect. I know it's not perfect, but it's way better than even Obamacare. No system is perfect, but I think in Quebec we can be rightly proud. We are the only province in Canada that has a formal vaccine injury compensation program. And it is very different from the United States program, which is adversarial. What happens in Quebec is, if someone believes that they or their child has been damaged by a vaccine, the family doctor, and the Ministry of Health doctor agree upon one or two other experts. Those experts meet with the family, meet with the child, discuss the case as a group to try to reach consensus. And in most cases, what the parents are looking for is information, credible information. And if you talk to them like human beings, you don't treat them as people who are out for a buck, in most cases, they walk away and say thank you. And nobody says thank you in the American court system. Nobody.
Before we thank Brian, I have just a couple of announcements. Next week's speaker, coincidentally, his title is Creationism, Evolution, and God. It's Brian Alters. Brian will give a great talk. He always does. Next week's moderator will be me again, it says here, so I'll be here. I want to thank the organizers and volunteers who've made this possible tonight, particularly Ingrid Berker, who prepares these notes. I'm just the front man for all the work that's done at this. Don't forget to fill out the evaluation form, please, as you're leaving. There will be people to catch it upstairs. And this is important. That's why I want to interrupt you from applauding Brian. Next week, we're not going to be in this room. We're going to be in an even nicer room, which is down the hall a little bit, and our trained volunteers will be around to help you get there. It will be in room 120, just down the hall from this room. So the last three mini-science lectures will be held in that different location. And with that, I'd like to thank Brian for giving one hell of a talk.
Thanks very much. Thanks for your attention. No speeding on the way home. Listen on the radio.